Morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for argument is Belbakir v. McHenry County. Ms. Foft.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel, and the administrator of the estate, Rashid Belbakir, and his wife. Hasiba Belbakir was a 27-year-old asylum applicant detained at the McHenry County Jail pursuant to a contract with the Immigration Customs Enforcement Agency. A jury must decide whether the defendant violated Hasiba's constitutional rights, resulting in her lying on her cell floor, wrapping her jail-issued knee socks around her neck, and with difficulty suffocating herself to death.
Of the three Centegra defendants,
yes,
only Ms. Frederick had actual knowledge that Ms. Belbakir was suicidal. Is that, am I right about that?
No, Your Honor, that's not correct because of the issue below that the district court judge indicated on the intake record of Ms. Belbakir when she came into the McHenry County Jail on March 9th. The intake officer checked the box yes to whether or not she was currently suicidal. Now, defendant's fee tax specifically says she reviewed that intake. She saw Ms. Belbakir when she came in, and she reviewed that intake form. So taking the inferences in the light most favorable to the plaintiff, she was extremely depressed or suicidal on intake and reported a prior history of suicide attempt. Now, furthermore, the entire medical file was accessible to Defendant Kaplan and Defendant Svitek. And Defendant Svitek specifically indicated that she reviews an entire medical file of all patients whom she dispenses medication to.
Now, but Nurse Kaplan was fairly proactive, wasn't she, in terms of responding progressively to the panic attacks? Would you agree with that?
Defendant Kaplan did respond when the correctional officers observed Hasiba non-responsive, unable to move her body, basically physically paralyzed. She did respond to those calls on March 12th and March 13th. She indicates she never asked her if she was suicidal. As the nurse manager of the jail, it is reasonable for the jury to infer that she reviewed the medical file. She knew the intake form. She knew she had reported a prior history of suicide attempt. She knew she was extremely depressed or suicidal on intake. She never even asked her. She did come. They did call the doctor. She was prescribed anti-anxiety medication. That's true. Defendant Svitek, as the nurse manager responsible for the entire department, which was right next door to Hasiba as she lay on the floor of her cell for the last 2 days of her life, basically, never came back to have any follow-up with Hasiba after March 13th.
But would you say that the most compelling point with respect to Nurse Svitek is that she didn't perform CPR, but then given that Ms. Belbashir's face and neck were black and blue in color and she wasn't breathing and, you know, she was cold to the touch, wouldn't it seem, you know, clear that she had been dead for some time?
Your Honor, I think that's one of the most compelling issues with regard to Defendant Svitek. Defendant Svitek also was there on intake, indicated that she reviewed the discharge papers, which is also an important issue that was in the medical file of Hasiba. There were hospital discharge papers from that same day that she was brought into the jail. Earlier that morning at the Stone Park Police Station, she exhibited such extreme symptoms that they took her to the emergency room. Those discharge papers required follow-up with the doctor. Defendant Svitek totally intentionally refused to deal with those discharge papers, blew them off, indicated that they were had to do with a urinary tract infection, and had no follow-up whatsoever. So
could I ask you, this is sort of more of a legal question. There is some discussion about whether a Fourth Amendment standard applies or whether the deliberate indifference standard that the Due Process Clause would impose for somebody who's not a convicted criminal applies. And I wonder if that's actually a line between, on the one side, Frederick, and on the other side, Kaplan and Svitak, because you might be able to show Kaplan and Svitak were objectively unreasonable, but I guess, like Judge Rovner, I'm searching for where the higher deliberate indifference, as opposed to, as you say, blowing it off, you know, being negligent, not paying the correct amount of attention, none of which is good, but, you know, the question is the federal constitutional implication here.
Absolutely, Your Honor, but I do think that deliberate indifference can be shown with regard to Defendant Kaplan and Defendant Svitak, knowing that they reviewed the medical record. Defendant Svitak said, when she was confronted with the contemporaneous record of Defendant Frederick, that this is going to crucify us, indicating, therefore, that would expose the deliberate indifference.
A different argument. This is civil commitment.
Yes, that's true, Your Honor. And
so why should the standards for, you know, people who are arrested or prisoners or what have you, why should that standard be applicable to civil commitments?
Well, Your Honor, I don't know that it would be a commitment, and I believe
I think the question is whether somebody who's been civilly committed is entitled to somewhat better treatment from their custodians.
Absolutely, Your Honor. She was not charged with a crime. She was not given any judicial process. So our argument is basically that she should receive at least...
Which is why you're saying at least objectively unreasonable. She has been seized, no doubt about that.
Correct.
Okay.
What is the evidence that Ms. Frederick was deliberately indifferent to the risk that she might harm herself, as opposed to the possibility that she was simply negligent?
Well, what distinguishes this case from all the other cases where summary judgment for defendants was upheld is simply this, that Hasiba specifically indicated she was suicidal. She never retracted those feelings.
Well,
she never denied those feelings.
There's the yes circled, and then there's the no circled.
Correct. But
It's not Frederick's report.
Right, that's one
no,
issue.
No, I know.
In Frederick's report contemporaneously recorded.
It's a report that, you know, hopefully everyone saw, so.
Exactly. So what we would say is what distinguishes this case is two incidences of specific, direct expression of suicide. That's the intake form, and that's a contemporaneous record recorded by Frederick.
So Frederick is the one who talks to her. Frederick has a greater level of knowledge because the death coming drip by drip comment and these other things are said directly to Frederick.
That's correct. And on the contemporaneous form, there's a box, suicidal, homicidal. She checked the box, suicidal. No question about that. The other issue with Defendant Frederick is after she completed the form, after she met with Hasiba, and you're right, this was her most desperate plea, where she said, I can't live like this. I cannot live like this. Defendant Frederick checks the box suicidal. She then, after she interviews Hasiba, tells a nurse she's suicidal. She clearly knows Hasiba is suicidal. She does nothing. The issue...
So do you think that her choices were simply doing nothing versus a full-blown suicide watch? Or do you have some notion of what you think the jail should have done to comply with its... constitutional responsibilities?
Well, they should have done something, and that's part of the issue, is that Frederick says after the fact that she didn't know that a suicidal prisoner like Hasiba would be more closely observed by a correctional officer if she had told somebody suicidal. And the corrections people, 201, when they were deposed, all said, if we had known there was a hint of suicide, we would have closely observed her. This is the issue with the lack of policy in this
right.
case.
I was going to ask you if you couldn't turn for a moment to your Monell claim, because you are saying that there at the, I gather this is a part three of a policymaker theory that you're pursuing.
That's correct, as an act of a final policymaker.
Not a pattern or practice or expressly written.
Correct, yeah. Correct. So the acts or the failure to act of the final policymakers here, Sheriff Nygren and Chief Svoboda, in not having an adequate constitutional suicide prevention policy is what provides a liability for the McHenry County defendants. And that is exemplified in three ways. One, there was no written policy.
Well, wait, they've delegated this to Sentegra, haven't they?
Well, Your Honor, they can't delegate away their constitutional duties.
They delegate the medical evaluation of the people who were committed.
Absolutely, but they...
And if the medical people don't advise the guards that there is a suicide risk, what difference would a policy have? I don't understand.
Well, Your Honor, the written policy aspect...
What should the policy be, in your view?
The policy, in our view, should be very specific. It should include a written policy. It should
include the contents. I don't care whether it's written.
So the contents, I thought you were following this ICE report that was issued that there should have been annual training of the actual jail correctional personnel, not just the medical people. And some of the other things that were in this report.
Absolutely.
Yes, what would that be, concretely?
That would be indicating and what the breakdown in this case was.
Concretely, look, you have guards, and you have this medical service to which the facility has turned over responsibility for medical supervision. Now, if the medical people fail to tell the guards that there's a patient who's suicidal, what are the guards supposed to do?
Well, so on page...
What would a policy have to do with it? What if the policy says to the guards, if you're advised by Sentegra that you have a suicidal person, then you should do X, Y, and Z? Well, if they're not warned by the medical people, but the absence of a policy is irrelevant.
Well, I think it shows in this case that, yes, the guards cannot...
No, but I thought you were arguing
because,
good faith.
Look, if the guards rationally defer to the medical people to tell them if there's an ill, whether mentally ill or physically ill, suicidal, what have you, if it's Sintegra's responsibility to warn these guards, then what is left for a policy?
Here's the concrete problem. It's
well,
communication.
Could I just say, I thought your argument, I'm looking at the ICE report, was that it is actually not enough to delegate it to Sentegra because the medical people are not around all the time, 24/7. The guards are. And what ICE says is you need staff training for recognition and intervention. And so maybe the question is where in the Constitution does that come from? Is it enough to delegate to the medical people, or does the policy have to include more?
Well, here's the concrete problem with the lack of policy, and that is that the guards didn't know how to observe Hasiba. They saw her lying on the floor with her head toward the door, huddled there. They couldn't see her from the window. They could only see her legs. If they had known... If they had been notified that she was suicidal, the policy should say specifically.
They weren't notified.
Right. And if there had been a policy that required notification,
notification by whom? You're talking about two different things. What the guards are supposed to be instructed and what Centegra is supposed to be instructed. Now, Centegra is instructed to notify the guards if they have a health problem. What more are the guards? What difference would it have made if they had an elaborate policy for guards? What difference would it make in this case?
Because they need to get a response from her.
Well,
they need to see her lying on the floor, and they need to have a response. And I see that I'm in my red zone.
You're done.
But we ask that the summary judgment be reversed.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hoff. Mr. Relaford?
Relaford, Your Honor. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel. Art Relaford for the Centegra defendants. Excuse me. I think this is a very sad and unfortunate case. And I think it boils down to...
So what is the standard of care for civil commitment?
In the case for a pretrial detainee or an immigration detainee, it will be deliberate indifference. There's got to be subjective knowledge.
Why? Why? I don't understand. Why is the criminal... Why is the standard for dealing with criminals... or arrestees, suspected criminals, why is that being applied to civil people civilly committed?
My suspicion, Your Honor, is that there's no probable cause hearing that's involved.
But that doesn't answer the question, because take civil commitment more generally.
Right.
Sometimes people are civilly committed because they're mentally disturbed. Sometimes they're civilly committed because there's an immigration issue. And, of course, there's not a Gerstein probable cause hearing, but if it's a mentally disturbed situation, there's a hearing that eventually happens within a relatively short period of time to make sure that this is an appropriate exercise of the state's power. In the case of an immigration detainee, there are proceedings set forth in the regulations that govern immigration procedures to decide whether continued detention is necessary, to decide whether the asylum request will be granted. This is a different sort of pattern, a different structure than the person who's arrested on suspicion of having committed a crime.
I agree.
And so why, that takes you to Judge Posner's question, why is a person who is being detained for immigration purposes or because they may be mentally ill and a danger to themselves or others, why is it this floor of deliberate indifference? And what in the Supreme Court's decisions tells you that that's the right standard?
I believe because the criminal element's not involved.
No, but why are you saying that's the standard anyway, then? The criminal element is not involved, and you're saying nonetheless they don't get treated any better than a suspected criminal.
Yeah, but I think the Seventh Circuit has spoken to that issue with respect to these types of detainees.
Not really. I mean, you can say that you flunk even the worst standard without saying what standard ought to be applied that's a higher standard. We certainly do have some cases where, in different situations, we've said, well, for the sake of argument, we'll apply deliberate indifference because you can't even survive that. But this is, I'm not aware of too many cases in the immigration area.
And they're not, Judge. But I do believe it's because the Fourth Amendment protections are not triggered by way of an immigration.
But you're not giving a reason. Suppose someone is acquitted, accused of crime, tried, acquitted on grounds of insanity, and then is placed in a mental hospital. Doesn't that person have the same right to medical care as anybody who's in federal custody?
Sure. And the standard for those persons who believe that they're...
Medical negligence, malpractice. Mm. If you take a person who is not a criminal, I'm saying this person has been acquitted, but he's in federal custody, isn't the ordinary standard of care applicable to this person? Why should it be diminished when it's not a criminal?
Well, because you've got a federal violation involved.
Tort Claims Act that applies negligence standards. Standards do exist in the federal system.
Here you're dealing with Section 1983, and so the claim is brought under the federal statute.
But it's vis-a-vis an immigration detainee who has not done anything other than ask for asylum when she came into O'Hare Airport. That's not a crime.
And she could bring her claim in state court, her negligence claim in state court.
And you would have removed, so we'd be right here.
There really were a number of red flags that were raised in Ms. Frederick's interview. And yet she didn't even alert the nurses or the guards to the fact that this person was suicidal, or have Dr. Vidak, the psychiatrist, see her immediately. So why couldn't a fact finder determine that she was deliberately indifferent? I mean, if that's, the standard that you're holding on to the possibility that this woman might very well harm herself.
She believed she was suicidal. We concede that.
I can't hear you.
We concede that Vicki Frederick believed she was suicidal.
And Vicki Frederick had this unrealistic sense of imminence, like unless Ms. Belbachir had said, I'm suicidal and I'm planning on taking my socks and on describing, her idea of imminence was ridiculous, actually, in light of what Ms. Belbachir was saying her.
But she did make the medical judgment, Your Honors, that she was not a high risk.
Well, and I'm saying, how could she have
do that?
Done that? I mean, it seems like it's reckless on the basis of this interview that she conducts.
Well, she's there. She's evaluating this lady.
She didn't give me a plan. Well, I mean, what inmate in a jail who doesn't even know what opportunities are going to be there is going to lay out for some total stranger their plan?
Well, Ms. Belbachir had been there for several days, but irrespective of that, she denied that she was going to harm herself.
She agreed to a plan for
medical treatment to see Dr. Vidak several days later. She agreed to take medication if Dr. Vidak prescribed that medication.
And at the same time, she's saying, I'd rather die. She's sobbing. Her behavior is sending very strong signals.
And we don't just sit on our hands. We follow up with questions. Do you plan on hurting yourself?
The nurse records this person, as she did, as being suicidal. And look at all the other things she circled. Hopeless, depression, anxiety, anger, agitation, crying, panic attack, hallucinations. This is a person with serious, very serious problems. Why not put her on suicide watch? What's the big deal? It's a guard peeking in every 10 minutes. Why don't they just do that? You think if a nurse says this person is suicidal and seems to be kind of nuts, actually, from all these other things, you'd say, well, we have a lot of jail suicides, particularly at the beginning of the incarceration, right? That's when people are most, they adjust eventually. It would be the simplest thing in the world to put her on suicide watch.
And you could simply put everybody on suicide watch.
Not everybody is said to be suicidal upon entry into the facility,
but they do
right?
have mental health
so why
issues.
Do you say something like that? You could do it for everybody.
They do have mental health issues. I think medically
it's
understood.
That is not an intelligent response. This person, why, if a nurse says this... this person is suicidal, why don't you put the person on suicide watch?
She didn't say she was suicidal.
That yes,
was
her, she did. She checked suicidal on the form.
For goodness' sake.
That was her conclusion. But there are varying levels of suicide risk.
That's even stronger if that's her conclusion.
But there are varying levels of suicide risk, which
the Seventh
Circuit has
considered.
And
that's what Judge Posner is saying. When you look at all the rest of the things that are checked on that form, she's at the high level. She's not at the low level.
Clinically, if you don't have a plan...
Oh, that is the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard.
It's medically appropriate, Your Honor.
That's ridiculous. Don't have a plan. I'm going to kill myself.
She denied.
What's your plan for killing yourself? Well, you know, I could take poison. I could run my head against the wall. I could strangle myself. I'm still thinking about the different plans.
If we take
and you say, oh, well, until
the,
you have a specific plan.
We take ourselves to the standard.
Don't interrupt me.
My apologies, Your Honor.
Your position appears to be, unless the person has a specific suicide plan, the jail policy is not to put the person on suicide watch. Is that your position?
That is a part of my position. Another part of my position is that the clinician feels, in his or her medical judgment, that the person is not at imminent risk or a substantial risk of suicide at that time, then suicide watch is not warranted.
Then what do we make of Ms. Kaplan's observation, quote, this note is going to crucify us? What do we make of that?
I think it's irrelevant. It's a post-death statement that she made in response to
it's an evaluation of the information in the note which was made pre-death.
But it doesn't have to do with what Vicki Frederick thought about this particular inmate
at
the time of her evaluation.
Your position seems to be that no matter what the person writes down in the note, Vicki Frederick, for example, as long as the bottom line is, I don't think it's imminent enough yet, it's fine for the jail to ignore the person. All you care about is that bottom line, no matter what terrible things are written beforehand.
No, that's not my bottom line.
Well, in other words, we're allowed to evaluate what the note says.
No, you've got to take into consideration the inmate's rights. I mean, you know, inmates have a right not to be.
Inmates do not have substantial privacy rights, and for a guard to peek in on a cell once every 10 minutes, I assure you, does not violate inmate privacy.
Suicide watch, if they're not imminently at risk of self-harm, they have a right not to be placed in suicide watch.
Where do you get that from?
That's law.
What case has ever said that?
I don't know the case, Your
Honor. There is no case that has said that. Inmates can be monitored for all sorts of reasons, for suicide reasons, for security reasons.
And for no reasons.
But medically... If you're looking at it from a medical perspective, they've got to take that consideration into effect, which is what they do. When looking at the totality of the circumstances, they weigh the inmate's right to be free from a suicide watch, be free from being tied down and bound within a cell with no freedom, versus not being on a suicide watch because they're not at imminent risk of harm, which is what Nurse Frederick concluded.
Thank you, Mr. Relifer.
Thank you, Nurse.
Ms. Hope Hoft, do you have anything further?
No, I think we have Mr. Henry Cassin.
Oh, we have another?
Mr. Cassin.
Oh, I'm sorry. Mr. Cassin? You're representing the jail? Jail guards?
Good morning. Their name is George Cassin, Your Honor, and I'm representing the McHenry County and Sheriff Nygren and Chief of Corrections Tom Savona. Plaintiffs have made a number of claims against 12 different McHenry County defendants.
But we just have Sheriff Nygren and Jail Chief Svoboda left, and I have a problem with your overall argument, which is that it seems to assume that Monell liability is in the nature of respondeat superior liability, in that if the lower person on the totem pole is found not to have done anything wrong, there can't be anything wrong at the higher level, at the county policy level. But, of course, Monell liability is not respondeat superior liability. There is no respondeat superior in 1983. And it's entirely possible as a theoretical matter that there could be a policy that's flawed, and yet the person lower down is not liable because perhaps they don't have the deliberate
intent, the subjective intent that's necessary. They're just following the policy, so they have a clean heart. So the fact that whatever may happen to the individual defendants doesn't tell us the answer to whether the final policymakers have failed their constitutional duties to have an acceptable policy.
But you still need, from a Monell liability, a constitutional violation.
You do.
On the part of the policymakers.
On the part of the policymakers, not on the part of the lower people in the totem pole, because that would be a pure respondeat superior theory, which is not it. Now, we can look at the policy here, which is criticized brutally in this ICE report that's issued after Ms. Velbachir's death. And there are all sorts of failures of policy that ICE identifies for the McHenry County Jail. McHenry County nearly loses its contract over this because there's no staff training for suicide prevention. There's no annual training, no formal training to the detention staff. The mental health intake screening not complete, no written procedure to define who goes on and who goes off suicide watch. Inconsistent 10-minute checks, and on and on. These are specific failures of the policy, which may or may not rise to a constitutional level, I understand.
Exactly,
that.
Your Honor. The ICE report doesn't view these things in terms of constitutional.
Of course standards. Not, but it gives us some constitutional, some baseline to think about. And whether total ignoring works is a different question.
The problem that the plaintiffs have, Your Honor, is that no court has said that it's a constitutional violation to not have a suicide prevention policy in writing. They had
of
a suicide prevention.
Did I say a word about writing? There can be issues of fact here about what the policy really was at McHenry County. Did you really have a policy where you were doing serious checks? Did you have a policy that trained not just the medical people, but the guards who were the first-line people? You say you had some training. They say it wasn't enough. It seems to me there might be some issues of fact about the content of your unwritten policy.
But the Seventh Circuit has said previously that the standard state of Illinois correctional training for officers is presumptively sufficient. You can't say that it is insufficient without establishing exactly why it is insufficient. And that hasn't been done here.
Well, wouldn't it be possible to show, for instance, that while the policymakers appreciated but ignored the risks of inadequate suicide prevention training, for example, the guards who lacked adequate training wouldn't have had the ability to recognize the signs that a detainee was suicidal under any circumstances here.
Is it enough to have the medical provider at the jail fully trained? Let's just assume for the sake of argument they are. Or does the Constitution require the guards to have adequate ability to detect suicidal signals? And another question is, you know, is there a continuum between absolutely assuming somebody's 100% healthy and a full-blown suicide watch? Is there some intermediate place along the line which would allow the guards to continue to assess?
You know, one important point here that I think hasn't been mentioned is that the Supreme Court in the Connick case has said whenever you have a claim, a Monell claim about training, that you have to have a series of prior incidents giving notice to the policymakers that their training has been insufficient.
That there's no notice given the record of jail suicides, even at McHenry County suicide attempts, but not to mention nationwide. One of these people was on the task force for suicide prevention. I'm shocked that you would think that that actually helps you.
Your Honor, you'd have to say then that you need to change the state of Illinois training, because that's what these officers received, was the training, the correctional training that was provided by the state of Illinois. There has been no court that has said that that in itself is insufficient.
Do you have anything in the record to show that this was annual or, you know, kind of a one-shot deal?
In what respect?
The state of Illinois training. Is it something you get once in your life and then you're done?
Yes, it's once, and then the County of McHenry has on-the-job training for their officers.
So that's a contested issue of fact, I think, because there is the ICE report that says there is no annual training. You're saying that there's evidence that there is annual training.
I said on-the-job training, Your Honor.
Not done
necessarily annually.
What's on-the-job training mean?
It's the period in which an officer coming on is taken through the whole system and trained on how to perform every job in the jail.
So how does that correctional training relate to suicide prevention and intervention? What happens?
What does
the record show happens for suicide prevention and intervention?
The officers are trained how to recognize what the warning signs are with respect to a potentially suicidal inmate.
Initial new employee orientation.
Say that again?
Only during their initial new employee orientation. Nothing else.
Both in correctional training and the on-the-job training.
I think the record is not 100% on that side.
Is there an intake form? So when someone is brought in, is the person interviewed and, you know, asked various questions?
Yes, Your Honor. There is a.
That include questions about related to suicide, depression, so on.
Yes, that form is part of the record here, and the intake officer asks, you know, the incoming inmate whether they've had prior suicidal incidents, whether they have suicidal thoughts, whether they're depressed. Depressed, and that form is then read by the.
Did she have such an interview?
Yes, she did.
So this is the form with the scratched out yes, though, which we have to take in the light most favorable to the plaintiff at this point. We understand that at trial you would say it wasn't a mistake, but it's very clear that yes was answered first, then it's crossed out, and then no was answered.
Was this given by an officer? By an officer, not by a Centegra nurse.
This was an intake by an officer, and then was reviewed by my nurse Fitak. But that officer, the district court determined that officer was not deliberately indifferent, and that is not contested on appeal.
No, nobody is saying that. But the information that he records initially is that yes, she is suicidal. And you're stuck with that at the moment.
That doesn't affect me at this point, Your Honor, because neither the sheriff nor the chief of corrections had any opportunity to see that.
Of course, no. You're confusing an individual suit between the sheriff. Nobody's bringing an individual suit against them for respondeat superior. The question is whether their policy, as the final policymakers, meets constitutional standards. That's the question.
Yes, Your Honor. And I think, Your Honor, that the Connick Court and the various decisions in this court dealing with Monell claims
But I don't think this is necessarily just a failure to train claim. I think it's really the content of the policy. What standards have you set forth for the jail for this very serious and common problem in jails? That's the issue.
The jail had very comprehensive standards with respect to suicide prevention. The officers were trained in this. They understood that. They testified in their depositions that this is what they understood they were to do, and they would do it. They did it in prior situations, And they would have done it in this situation if they had been apprised of the fact that this detainee had suicidal impulses to the point that she was a serious suicide risk. They did not receive that instruction from the...
You know, it's interesting.
And the district court has held that they were entitled to the presumption that the professional judgment standard...
All right. So if the professional... Let me just ask you a hypothetical. Forget about suicide. So suppose they see for a period of several days a detainee at the jail who is lying on the floor in his or her cell, not moving significantly, maybe a twitch here, a twitch there, curled up in the fetal position. Is it their view that that's none of their business? They just walk by?
Well, first of all, those are not the facts
here. I'm asking you a hypothetical.
I think that the guards in that situation would be required to report what they had seen to their supervisors and then to medical personnel and make a decision as to whether that person, opening the cell door and making a decision as to whether that person needed some additional care.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Hoff, do you have anything further?
No, Your Honor, unless there are additional questions.
Okay, well, thank you very much to you, Ms. Hoff, and to...